The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A fairly common idea about human development is that children develop in a variety of different ways over their growing up. And so there's psychological, developmental psychological ideas about how they developed psychologically, how they developed physically, how they developed socially, how they develop ethically, the moral development in children. Some people have offered some stages to that. If everything goes normal, how that grows and develops over time. And so there's all kinds of developmental models people have for the maturation of children. And then when people turn 18, it just stops. when you turn 18, that developmental model, the growth and the change and maturation continues into adulthood. And there's a variety of ways of studying the maturation, the continued psychological development of human beings into adulthood and right up into old age. And people have stages and models of how things evolve. And religions do the same thing. The religions have developmental models of a variety of things. And Buddhism has it as well. And Buddhism is considered oriented, especially Indian Buddhism, is oriented towards developmental models of people's development in their practice, in their spiritual life, in their Buddhist life. And there's many of these models. Some of you might be familiar with the 10 ox herding pictures, which they have in Zen, which is 10 stages that people supposedly go through in Zen training. Some of these, it's a little bit, I don't know if it's arbitrary to decide which model to use. You can use different models for different purposes and study yourself and understand yourself as you grow. But the important thing to understand is that there are changes and phases in a person's involvement with something like Buddhist practice, with mindfulness practice, with growth into, through adulthood. And you can probably, through different lenses, you could look at your own life and see that look back over your life to this date and see that you've grown and developed and changed in various ways and the influence is on you. And if you're lucky enough to be an elder, you have more data. And so you can go back and see some of the changes that stand out in contrast now, looking back in time, that perhaps weren't obvious to you. You're in the middle of it. And when you're in the middle of it, that's just the way the universe is. But then later you realize, oh, that was just a particular phase of my life, and I was learning certain things, I was growing in certain ways, and that's how it was. So what I'd like to do is to offer you my own reflections, perspective, with the help of other people's ideas, of what I've seen in myself and other people of kind of stages in spiritual growth and development. And don't take it too seriously, what I'm going to say. It might be peculiar to, kind of a Western psychological culture kind of orientation, the choices that I'm using here. It's certainly not a classic Buddhist stages, but maybe you'll find it interesting. And if you don't find it particularly interesting, the idea, that it'll fit you in some way, then maybe it just prompts you to kind of consider a little bit the idea of phases that you might be going through and the shifts and changes over time that you go through when you're involved in Buddhist practice. So one of the first stages for many people is inspiration, enthusiasm. Some people call it the honeymoon phase. And that is, some people will encounter something like Buddhist practice, Buddhism, and some people get really excited. Some people, they come to their first talk, or read their first book, and they say, I'm home. This is right. this is finally, finally someone's talking about something I can that makes sense for me, makes sense of my life, the world we're in. It's not uncommon for people to really appreciate that finally someone's talking about suffering. And because there's a lot of suffering and everyone else was pretending it wasn't there. And so sometimes Buddhists like to just kind of face it directly. Or the idea that there's a practice or a path, or that there you can see in certain people certain maturation, spiritual maturation. You say, oh, that is inspiring. I really like whatever that person has, I would like to have that. I've had people tell me that. They met some teacher and said, I want to have that. That's meaningful for me. And so for a variety of ways, people can get very enthusiastic, inspired. And it helps, of course, in Buddhism, that Buddhism is a world religion. One of the great, I don't know how many great world religions there are, but in the class of great world religions, Buddhism is one of them. And it's nice to be associated with something that's great. And so that kind of adds a certain pizzazz and, you know, a certain kind of aura of authority and to this enthusiasm initially. So that's one phase often people begin with. It doesn't have to be that way. And next one that often follows that, or either directly or sooner or later, is disappointment. And that is, you start hanging around in Buddhist groups, and they pick their noses. You know, they're not kind of as you know, not quite what you thought they were. You know, you thought that they were all the Buddhists. You know, you go to a Buddhist center, and like you know, everybody be in clouds and be so nice and so radiant and shining, and then they don't clean the toilet when they finish going to the bathroom, and like, what's going on here? Or something, something that they don't live up to the ideals we have. In the inspiration, honeymoon phase, there's a lot of idealism, and the Buddhism practice is going to do so many wonderful things for us, so much great for the world, and everyone should be a Buddhist, and then you start hanging out with it, and it doesn't seem to be, people don't seem to be what you expect them to be. I've lived in many Buddhist communities, and from the outside, the Buddhist community seemed pretty ideal. A lot of people want to go live there. Wow, those are great people. But it doesn't take long in living there to realize that it's generally that the people who have a lot of need, personal need, have real challenges in their life, a lot of suffering, are the ones who end up living at centers. They're kind of like hospitals. And so all this idealism about, you know, these people are going to be, you know, so wonderful doesn't quite live up to it's what we were expecting. And some people get really disappointed, not realizing that what a great gift these centers and practice communities are for people who need that kind of medicine. But, you know, initially it can be quite disappointing. Or get disappointed in a teacher. I remember when I was first involved with Zen practice, I had this idealism. And then I saw the car that the Zen master drove. Now, I was like, you know, I was a back-to-the-land hippie. You know, I would sew my own clothes, grow my own food, was vegan, you know, just before they hadn't even knew the word. And, you know, living really simply and trying not to have an impact on the environment and the world as little as possible in terms of energy and all this. And he was driving an Audi. Now, some of you might have an Audi, so this is not meant to be a critique for you, but it wasn't in my image, you know, that a Zen master would drive an Audi, just like something like didn't fit. Not only that, but his license plate said 00 Zen. it was great. It was really beneficial for me to see that because immediately I was disappointed in the teacher, and I decided I made a decision which maybe wasn't wise, but it served me. I decided I can't support or be interested in how this person's living his life, some of his lifestyle choices, but I think I can learn something about Zen from this person. So I kind of made a split and focused on learning some, what he had to teach me, rather than seeing this person as, you know, the embodiment of perfection. And so eventually when there was a big scandal with this abbot and he had to resign and he left and all that, that many people felt deeply betrayed because they held him up in some kind of ideal. But because I saw his car and was disappointed early on, you know, I was able to kind of, you know, I wasn't so disappointed in him, and, you know, and I felt like I did learn a lot from him. I'm not saying that's a wise strategy, you know, to make that kind of division, see people through those two ways, but it certainly served me. So we see our teachers don't live up to what we, you know, how we're supposed to be, how they're supposed to be, and so they get disappointed, you know. I'm sure people, I guess, get disappointed in me when they realize that I'm not very quick at answering emails. And that's good, to be disappointed a little bit. You should be, because, you know, teachers shouldn't be held up on some pedestal. And and then people get disappointed in, you know, the teachings or something, or all kinds of ways we get disappointed, we get disillusioned. And I love it when people get disillusioned with Buddhism. I think it's really great, because to be disillusioned means to no longer have illusions. So it's a phase that people go through, but the trick is some people then will leave the Buddhism, will give up on it, will just go on to something else. And the more idealistic people are at the beginning, the more likely they're going to be disappointed, and the more likely they'll go transfer that idealism somewhere else. And I've seen a number of people who just go around, and they just, you know, everything, whatever they come to, it's like, that's the greatest. And then that lasts for a year or two, and then it's the next guru coming to town. That's the greatest. So one way or the other, there's a disappointment phase that people go through. Then there's a time of followed by some people by I call it distress, a period of distress, and there's an anxiety, fear, personal pain. Sometimes people call it the dark night of the soul. So we stay beyond the kind of disappointment phase and kind of hang in there. And then at some point, what we realize is that we have to face ourselves. We begin looking at ourselves and our deeper issues start coming out. And there's a lot of deeper issues that come out. Deeper issues which are sometimes hidden when we're enthusiastic, when we're kind of in the glow of, oh, this is so wonderful. And are often hidden when we get disappointed, because the disappointment sometimes is we're still looking externally. We're looking out there, that Buddhism is going to save me, the teachers are going to do it, the teachings or whatever. And so at some point when we continue practicing after the idealism and after the disappointment, then people start really showing up for themselves. And it's kind of like, probably you know that one of the theories of therapy, psychotherapy, is that this therapy doesn't begin until you're angry with your therapist. And I don't know if the same principle applies, but I've heard that in Judaism there's a saying that if a good percentage of the congregation is not upset with the rabbi is not doing his or her job. So, but the idea is that sooner or later that. And the part of the idea is that at some point we're facing ourselves, we're challenged in ourselves. And so we start seeing ourselves, and some of self-knowledge is not good news. And so it can be distressing to really notice, wow, how much fear I have, or how egotistical I am, or how much I've been running away from my grief, or how much delusion I have, or all kinds of things. We start seeing ourselves in a deeper way. And so it's a period of distress. And that can last for a long time. Some of it can be quite surprising. Some of it can be deeply existential, where the kind of sense of meaning and purpose in life begins to kind of fall away. And it's one thing to be energized by having ideals and being enthused by ideals. There is a syndrome in Buddhist practice I've seen of people who use Buddhist teachings and use, like, reading books or listening to talks as a way to kind of keep getting a little high, keep getting kind of inspired. And then that inspiration carries them for a while, and then they go get another hit, get inspired. And it can be fine to do that. It has its value. But if it's done in such a way that we're always being distracted from ourselves and never really settling and looking at what's here, it's not that useful. So there's a period where you have to face where it's kind of difficult. It's kind of like challenging. And the most extreme forms of it sometimes in Western spirituality is called dark nights of the soul. And somehow as that settles in and as we see the benefit of practice in spite of the challenges, the personal challenges we have and the difficulties going on, then at some point people come to an area where they develop a commitment, or they struggle with commitment. Should I do this? Should I really give myself over to this? Is this really valuable enough? This is challenging. It's hard work. Is this something that I want to devote my life to in a deep way? Are there priorities I want to do? And some people at this point will sometimes decide, well, I have other priorities I want to do. I'm not really committed to this. And some people decide they are committed. This is something they're really going to give themselves over to and really make central to their lives. When I was practicing at the San Francisco Zen Center, early on, one of the teachers there said that he observed that many of the people who came to Zen Center and for their first 3 to 5 years of being there were mostly there to find themselves and discover who they were. They were often young, and there are issues of identity, issue of their place in society, issues about their relationship to their family, their religion of origin, their society, were all kind of part of what they were trying to grapple with. And after 3 or 5 years, some people start to find themselves. Some people found that they really liked their religion of origin, and they went back to it, which was, you know, they find value in it. Some people went and reconciled with their family. Some people kind of found work skills or learned how to work, be, live in society, in community. And so then they could, with that stability, they felt they could go back into society and get work and do things. And so there was a turnover at Zen Center of people who left after 3 or 5 years and found themselves. But then the teacher who told me this said, those people who stay beyond the 3 to 5 years, they start doing Buddhist practice. I didn't ask what they were, you know, the assumption was they weren't doing it before, I guess, the way it was stated. So it was a little odd. But you know, at some point there's a commitment. At some point we get over a certain hump and we settle in. And we really, it's not just a matter of doing, you know, personal psychological work, dealing with our own suffering and pain, but there's some greater value when you feel this is what I want my life to be about or what I really want to do. So a sense of resolve that can see us through the dark night, see us through the difficulties we have. And then, at some point, people will come to a dry place where things get really kind of bland, or you know, there's not a lot of traction, or there's not a lot of inspiration, it's not a lot of hard work anymore, it's not difficult anymore, but you know, we settle in, there's a certain maybe complacency, but it's just kind of like we're just going along, and it's not really doing much. We are committed, we keep going through the motions, but not really coming alive and not really feeling like we're making a lot of progress. We're kind of like threading water or running in place or something. And this is an important phase. Sometimes I think it's kind of like if you're driving an old stick shift car and you sometimes you get from, you know, second to third gear, you have to go through neutral. And so when I was really young, we had a car where we had to push the clutch in, put the car in neutral, release the clutch, push the clutch back in again to get it into like next gear. It was a whole very complicated thing. And so sometimes we have to be in neutral this dry place, this kind of bland place, nothing really going on, and keep making the effort. But it's so hard to do that because, you know, what's the point when it seems so dry and, you know, not so engaged? Some people, it ends up being kind of dry or bland, the practice, because of complacency. They've kind of settled in, they're resolved, and some of the benefits of the practice are coming, and they're not really struggling psychologically, there's not a lot of suffering anymore, there's a kind of contentment. And so people just settle in, and so they kind of just go through the motions, and not really, in some ways, sometimes because they're not really engaged anymore in some alive way, or questioning, or investigating deeply. So coming to a dry place. And then there's a time when, either before or after this, you know, these stages don't have to be all linear, there's a feeling of really coming home, really feeling a peace, a deep appreciation, kind of at home with oneself, and home in this world, and kind of like just willing to kind of abide or live in your skin, comfortable with yourself, comfortable with just being, breathing and being here. Just to be alive is enough, and just to be. There's no need to make progress. There's no need to avoid anything. There's no need to prove oneself. There's no need to get, Buddhist medals to prove how, you know, far you've come. It's just enough just to be content and happy, and it's a great sense of peace that can come. This sometimes is followed with a greater sense of appreciation and love and the desire for service. So people feel they've gotten a lot of benefit, they're settled in, and it feels, you know, there's kind of maybe an openness, a connectedness to the world around them, and that connectedness and that settledness and their own happiness is something they want to share, those benefits in the practice they've had with others. They want to bring their goodness to support and help other people in all kinds of ways. And so sometimes there's this phase of service and love and compassion that grows and develops. And then as the final phase, or actually the penultimate phase as I see it, there can be some deep experience of liberation, some deep freedom, where some of the deepest attachments we have, deepest clingings to self, self-concept, the deepest kinds of fears we have about even death, so kind of liberated from it, so that even death doesn't seem like a scary topic, doesn't, scary thing. It's like, and there's a freedom, a deep freedom, sense of liberation that comes. Many people who teach start teaching before they have the full liberation. Some people, start teaching after, but there's a sense of liberation. And then the last phase, I call integration. And that is that people will have some genuine experience of freedom, liberation, awakening, some real kind of like a realization experience, deep understanding. And then, but they're not finished. But then it's a matter of taking that understanding, taking that experience, taking that reference point, and applying it to their life more fully. Begin kind of letting it spread out so that it's integrated, it's applied, it becomes holistically included everywhere. And then in some ways, the cycles, all these phases, you start over again. And you go through the same thing. It's kind of a spiral. And it's not like just, it's not like you're done. Get some experience of liberation, then you're done. And then you start over again, and you have to kind of apply it. So you learn, maybe you're free of, one of the classic understandings is to have a real clear insight, understanding, realization of a way of being present in this life, fully present, without any reference to self. And you realize it's possible. It's a milestone experience, milestone sense. But then there's still lots of conceit. There's still a lot of selfing going on. But now you have a different way of seeing it. And then the integration phase is slowly beginning to kind of work through those, all the conceit, all the ways in which we're playing the self game, and begin settling them and calming them down and not be caught by any of them. Or have a very deep experience of what it's like to have absolutely no addictive desires whatsoever, or no fear whatsoever. And know that as a possibility, it's visceral in the whole system. And then to know, recognize, well, it actually still is some fear. There still is some attachments and clinging that we want. And so then kind of begin kind of looking at that from a different vantage point and learn, no, there's have a reference point that there is another way. There is, it's kind of like having gone deeper in the heart, and then know that in the depth there's something that holds it all. And if we just kind of settle deeper, then we won't stay at these higher levels where there's fear or attachment or hate or all these things operating. So the integration phase is to kind of work through those and all the different corners and facets of our life. There's not a few people who will follow very deeply this path and have some genuine experience of freedom and openness, and after which the integration time is very intense. It's very difficult because it kind of like has opened a vista and understanding that allows some of the deeper unresolved issues to come flooding in. And so part of these phases of practice, and why the integration practice is so important to understand, is that sometimes people are very much taken by surprise by what comes up. And that's generally, I mean, I don't know, it's maybe half the time or a certain good percentage of the time that people do the practice, feel the benefits of it, have something really, really strong benefit from it, that following the big periods of benefit, it becomes another time of challenge, because now it's going to be integrated and developed into our lives. So those are some stages that I've seen that some people go through. There are other perspectives or reference point for seeing how people change. A common one that's used in the West sometimes is development of self-concept, development of the self. And we go through being selfish, self-absorbed, self-referential, to having an interpersonal sense of self, to having a altruistic sense of self, to having kind of some people called it a universal sense of self, and you know what the Buddhists would call having no self, and having letting go of all concept of self and being held by the Dharma or the universe, and not having the reference point of self anymore. So this the evolvement of sense of self over time. So at any of these stages that people go through, other developmental issues that people are working with can come in and make it difficult. So if we come to a place of distress, fear, a phase of fear or distress, and a person developmentally, maybe as a child, had a lot of insecurity, a lot of challenges, a lot of, didn't have a lot of stability. And it's very hard then sometimes to go through a spiritual stage of distress because it touches into this psychological undeveloped area in their life where there's a lot of lack of trust. And so then maybe they, leave and go do something else and find something else to try out. And so all along, there are challenges that come along. But these are all kind of part of the territory if you want to walk this path. Those people who have walked the path and seen, gone far enough, there tends to be a tremendous trust that develops in the path itself, in the process, in the practice itself. So people who do mindfulness practice find with time a phenomenal trust in the unfolding, in the opening, in the benefits that come from being mindful. So much so that some people will say that as long as I can be mindful, whatever I'm going through is trustable. If I can't be mindful, I don't know if I can trust what's happening. It kind of means if I'm not mindful, maybe I can't trust myself, my reaction, my responses. But if we're mindful, it's all workable. We can find our way through anything. And that gives a lot of confidence to people that, yes, I can, this can be, I can go anywhere. I don't necessarily know what needs to happen. I don't understand the situation. But if I'm mindful, we'll find a way. So for those of you who are involved in this, you know, on a regular basis in Buddhism, mindfulness practice, meditation, you might want to consider that what you go through is a phase. So you don't universalize. You don't say, oh, and this is how it's going to be forever. This is, you know, oh, right now, this is what's happening to me. And then in that kind of, oh, just now, this may be just a phase, then there could be an openness to other possibilities. We don't make grand conclusions. You know, to get some benefit from the practice and then conclude, you know, I am Buddha's gift to humanity. You know, and I, you know, when I was in the first few years of Zen practice, I was so in love with Zen practice and the benefits and the teachings that I would sit and listen to Dharma talks and then while I was listening, compose my own. These great Dharma talks I was going to give. And, you know, not recognizing it. We hardly understood Buddhism at that point, but it didn't matter, you know. If I'd understood, oh, this is a phase to have this kind of enthusiasm. Oh, just a phase to go through this. Then I would have held it more lightly, and I would have been more open to move on to the next phase or to see fresh. Or times when I was discouraged in the practice, if I had just known, oh, this is a phase of discouragement. This is to be expected. Or if you hear that you're supposed to be disillusioned sooner or later, then if it happens you get disillusioned, you say, oh, right on time. So that's how it is. So then, you know, but don't hurry it along. Don't go out now and look to be disillusioned. You know, think, oh, it's an important phase. I better figure out. I'll go see what kind of car Gail drives. You know, if you want to give me a Tesla, then I can really help you all out. I'll be sure to park it in front. And if you gave me a Tesla, I'd probably sell it and use the money for something else. So the idea is, if you think of this in terms of phases, maybe it keeps you more open and keeps you going and just kind of makes you more interested and curious and puts things in context rather than think that this is it. I've arrived or it's always going to be this way. And also kind of gives you the question, you know, how can I grow more? What area in my life am I ready to open up to next? Or what needs to be worked on now? Or what needs to be integrated now? Or what do I have to accept now? Some of these phases are not to be gone through quickly, but rather to be accepted. Oh, I'm just in this phase. Okay, so I have this work to do now. This is what I'm dealing with. So like the dry place, it can be very hard because it can be a very strong feeling that it shouldn't be dry. It should be inspiring. It should be wonderful. And it should be great. And it should be making progress. And don't want to waste my time. But maybe hearing that people go through a dry phase, maybe it's just you have to allow each phase its due. You can't really speed through some of the phases just because you know they're there. So knowing their phases can help you be open to new possibilities and growth, but also can know, oh, I have to just accept this, just this now. I don't know how long it's going to last. I'll offer my sincere practice to it, and with that, I hope that it will unfold in due time. Then the last thing I'd like to say is it can be useful to think of the progress and phases of practice over time. It can also be a hindrance. It can also be a hindrance to kind of think this way and be so concerned about it. Where am I and how am I and how am I compared to other people and they're ahead of me and that's terrible. I better speed up. Or there's competitive practice, you know, going to be farther. You know, it's all kinds of problems, measuring yourself by it. But I hope that you can hold it lightly and you hold it in such a way that it's useful. And in the end, the most useful thing you have for practice, what I've seen most, is not where you are, how far you've gotten, but rather is your sincerity in the practice. So you offer your sincerity. Your sincerity means your honesty, your commitment, your goodness, your trust, certain kind of humility or humbleness, like, Yes. Maybe realizing that you have to offer yourself in a full, complete way, and that the Dharma knows better than you do what's supposed to happen next. So, we have about 5 minutes before the end. So does anyone have any questions or comments about this? Yes, please. It's coming here from the front.
Thanks. Yeah, it's this balance of expectations of understanding the face and wanting different or expecting a farther in the path, whatever we want to call it, or and the whole thing of the cause of suffering is, that's where I see it, conflict is, the more understand it intellectually, the more of there is a more direction to the path, or there is more description to how to go through. The more I see myself, I'm going to be attaching to a method or a process.
It's true. So one approach to what you're describing is to welcome your attachment. Don't worry about it. Because what we're trying to do with mindfulness practice is we want to use our mindfulness to catch those things, to see those things. If you have a tendency to get attached, anyway, if you never see, the tendency never gets triggered, maybe you're more comfortable, but that you haven't really met yourself and dealt with those. So if after this talk you find yourself more attached now to, you know, progress and phases, just be welcoming to the attachment as something to learn from, to study and get to know better. And you could, that's one of the part of trusting mindfulness. If you're doing a mindfulness practice, you're going to start, sooner or later, you're going to notice the ways that you're contracted, caught by your attitude and your relationship to these things. And if you're caught in wanting to get somewhere, you'll feel it physically in your mind, in your heart. And you'll notice, you get a sense, oh, this doesn't work to be contracted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In some cases, I mean, I see this is, there is a general direction, and there is non-attachment to it, and there's acceptance and going back to it. So very accepting to the fact that I could be practicing very regularly or not at all for a long time, and I'm okay with both.
Yeah. That's good. So this is, so if I may, what you said was you're okay with practicing or not practicing, which is maybe a sign of your maturity, and that's great. But and that kind of can also be swing over very to complacency, and to kind of so that's why the idea of commitment and resolve is important as well, and not kind of drift off. So the idea of the whole commitment phase, where we decide, you know, to be resolved, has a lot to do with understanding what our real intention is. And it's a beautiful thing. Not everyone has this, but some people who really decide that the practice is at the heart of their life. One of my Zen teachers said that a lot of people came to him and asked, how do I integrate my practice into my life? Which is a very sincere and beautiful thing to ask, because practice is important, and how do you bring it to your life? But he, after a while, people kept asking this question. I think he got a little bit, he saw the limitation of that kind of approach. And so he proposed that people could ask a different question, was how do you integrate your life into your practice? So anyway, I think what your question you're asking are good, very good, and I think that just keep welcoming what's happening and study it with your mindfulness.
Thank you.
Yes, one more.
When you were talking about the different phases, I think they're life phases, and I think you may have mentioned that. I've always had trouble being a boss, you know, and having people follow whatever I say, and I work with some young adults that are like 25. And I just realized I'm seeing them go through these phases. They start out very ideal, maybe not confident. They build up their confidence, and you see this idealism, and then the distress. And it's the distress that has caught me as a boss. I think it's geared towards myself, but it's not. It's this one particular young lady is going through an awakening of, she's fearful of people being hugging her or saying things that she needs to say. She's afraid, and she's making these little quips and sarcasms that I would normally take personally, but I see that she's struggling with that distress stage, and she's seeing things that she has to work with. And it really helped me see on the other side of the fence.
Yeah.
I can help her through that by not making it personal.
So sometimes if we understand that it's a phase people go through, then we can have more care and compassion for them and hold them. So it's true. Great. So I hope you at least enjoy it all. Enjoy the journey. It's great. It's a great journey to go on. Thank you all.